Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Rhodes Australia's podcast, The Hub. My name is Mitch Itter, and I'm the Corporate Affairs Officer here at Rhodes Australia. Today, we're bringing you the second in our series of panel discussion summaries from RA's Transport Summit, held earlier in the year. If you missed the first of these, simply scroll through the Hub episodes on your podcast streaming service or visit our website to listen into Convergence, How Decarbonisation Drives Transport Productivity, a fantastic discussion on the changing face of transport and the challenges and opportunities that exist in the transport reform policy space. This episode is focused on sustainability and the opportunities that exist to utilise circular economy principles across the transport and infrastructure sectors, while also considering potential policy shifts to continue supporting the decarbonisation journey of the industry. RA's sustainability policy stream recognises the impact transport infrastructure has on the environment and climate change, and that a strong partnership between government and industry is required to meet national and global sustainability goals, as well as community expectations. Sustainability continues to be a strong focus of Rhodes Australia, following the release of the Journey to Net Zero report last year, with the support of KPMG, the Australasian Railway Association, Infrastructure Sustainability Council, and ARIP. This panel discussion was only possible through the generous support of Tonkin and Taylor. Nicole Neal, Tonkin and Taylor's Chief Executive Australia, moderated the panel discussion, introduced the other panellists, and outlined the importance of expanding circular economy uptake across the transport sector.
So there's many factors, including waste resource standards, state government waste policies and environmental protection that are all driving forces for the transport infrastructure industry to adopt a circular approach to resource requirements in infrastructure. The industry has been using recycled materials for decades, kind of a little bit old hat now, and that demonstrates a willingness to adopt circular economy principles. Governments have begun to adopt circular economy principles and to realise the benefits such as cost savings, reduced landfill and emissions reductions. So the session this morning will discuss how the industry's existing enthusiasm for recycled materials can be harnessed to leapfrog those recycling targets and adopt a circular approach to resource requirements in infrastructure. So, please welcome our distinguished panellists this morning. We have Alexandra Monson. She is Group Manager Sustainability at Ventia. We also have Big Noonan joining us on the panel, Chief Executive Officer at Athiona. And last but definitely very much not least, Joan Coe, Principal Climate Sustainability Leader for ARIP Australasia. Joan is also Co-Deputy Chair, along with myself, of the Rhodes Australia Sustainability Committee. So, circular approaches, circular economy. Let's just get us all on the same page there. So, circular economy is a concept that aims to shift away from the traditional take, make, dispose economy or value chain towards newer and different models or loops, with the potential to bring about various benefits, not only in terms of waste and resource use, but also in terms of economic and social factors too. Environmentally, in addition to the obvious elements of materials and waste, circular approaches can have an impact on carbon emissions. By reducing waste and increasing the use of renewable resources and even questioning the need to generate new infrastructure over sweating existing assets, circular approaches therefore can help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. From an economic perspective, circular approaches can create new business opportunities and increase resource efficiency, which can then lead to cost savings and increase competitiveness. Further to this, circular approaches can have socioeconomic benefits through the creation of new employment opportunities and business models and broader social benefits that improve the health and well-being of communities. Overall, the circular economy is a comprehensive approach that considers the interconnectedness of environmental, economic, and social factors.
Joan began the panel discussion by encouraging a sustainability-focused approach to infrastructure and a detailed multi-step thought process before considering the construction of new infrastructure, elaborated on by Alexandra, who highlighted the need to consider the whole life cycle of assets and strong maintenance and management procedures.
or recycled content, and I'm from Victoria, really picked up steam when China closed the borders on accepting our rubbish. And so in many ways, I think of recycled content policies in transport as not a circular economy response for transport. It was transport reaching out to solve a waste problem, because the circular economy is about using the things that we've got to their highest and best value for as long as possible. And for us, the roads, the most underutilized asset are the lanes going the opposite direction during peak hour. So we must consider, as Japan did, maybe instead of building new construction, we can change business hours, flow things in a different direction. Maybe we can use data to consolidate freight. Maybe we can use digital and data systems to smooth out flow and get more movement that we need without building the extra infrastructure. Let's not wait for all the policy settings, the EPDs, the carbon pricing. We already know the answer. It's really simple, just four things. Questions for all of us. Number one, do you need to build it? And then if you do need to build it, number two, if you build it, can it do more than one thing? Because if it can do two things, you've halved the resources. Number three, if you build it, can it be passive? Because the more actively you have to maintain and paint and upgrade and look after it, very likely to be resource intensive. And then finally, number four, if you need to build it, can you switch the materials? So then you do recycled content. If you keep it at the one, two, three, you'll be cheaper as you go into the circular economy. And it's only number four that you start taking on risk and cost.
So the greatest impact of that infrastructure is generally through the operational part of the life cycle. And that's where I think that there's that circular economy opportunity to reduce impact during that life cycle. By taking an asset management approach and thinking what's the intended outcome of that asset and the way that we use it, to keep that material serving its purpose creating the most value for as long as possible. And that's really where preventative maintenance and asset monitoring really has a key role to play.
BEAD outlined the need to provide industry with certainty and reliable long-term approaches to sustainability and decarbonisation, including the requirement for a consistent approach to carbon measurement.
What we cry out for is consistency and certainty in most things we do. So lurching about and having grand ideas and great thinking is terrific, but not having a platform of certainty of understanding the rules is tough. So we're in a world at the moment where our society has got great intention, has moved an enormous amount, and the acceptance of climate change is largely universal. But what we don't have is any consistency around how we're going to operate and what are we going to build, why we're going to build it, and you know, what is the how we're going to be measured. So that's the area now that I think is the challenge for us that we have to address. But in the meantime, hopefully state governments, who are actually the biggest users of carbon, can actually come about and say, how are we going to actually manage this? And we, as the constructors and the investors, need to have a consistent approach, and an approach that is long-term, that's not just going to fluctuate and change. To me, that's got to be a form of measurement that's consistent, and then a pricing that's consistent. As a business, we already have our own approach to carbon, where every ton of carbon we put a price on internally, and we pay into an internal fund that then we draw down on for R&D projects internally. And so, you know, measuring carbon, putting a price on carbon is something that we can all do. I think our industry and Roads Australia have got a tremendous opportunity to actually lead the way and say, we need to measure this and we need to measure it consistently and come up with it. The other aspect, that there's two other things that will do. And I think to the point that Joan made earlier about deciding on what assets get built is really important. And we all get frustrated about politicians coming up and saying, we're going to build that. Sometimes there's cost-benefit analysis, most of the time, you know, Infrastructure Australia and the infrastructure departments around the state, but sometimes not. Now, our society, if we are smart about it, we can overcome that political sort of opportunistic views by demanding that there's actually a holistic, whole-of-life attitude to the carbon impact and the sustainability impact of the asset. Next step is, I think there's a huge opportunity to reduce the amount of materials that we're using, as well as the recycling part, which is secondary, but the reduction of materials at any particular project. Australia is an incredibly high standards and specification environment. So, but I think both of those parts can really only be effective if we get that measurement and pricing approach so that we can have consistency, so the companies actually have a reason for investing into lower carbon products in their supply chain, as opposed to us continuing to buy high carbon reinforcing steel out of offshore without any impact, and we just put it in our projects. So there's no impetus to actually reduce the carbon.
Alexandra discussed some of the barriers, including gaps in knowledge and measurement, that are hampering the uptake of products contributing to decarbonisation and more efficient asset management, before Joan described how the complexity of the infrastructure value chain can hamper more efficient practice.
Yeah, I think on the specifications in particular, we over-specify in a range of areas, but even when there is an appetite to innovate and do something different, perhaps risk and some contractual, that other barriers to prevent that as well. And I think then there's a gap in knowledge and certainly in measurement, as Bede said. So even where there are products available or different solutions, are we all aware of them? So do we have access to the right solutions? We're buying a product now. Are we aware of an alternative or a different organisation, a different way that we can partner with others to do that? Are we all having access to and sharing the great successes that we do see, which is a really positive step?
I mean, the reason why infrastructure and the built environment is very complicated value chain, where we're all like broken up with subcontractors and contractors, insurers and financiers. And we all control this tiny little slice of a system, and everyone feels like they can't do anything. So we lock each other into a linear economy. And so as an example, under roads, there's the opportunity for a combined services tunnel. You know, maybe we could have a tunnel. Maybe we could run water, electricity, gas through it. Maybe some big superannuation company could own a big tunnel and charge rent for that space. Every time we try to do this and then reduce the number of digging up of roads we have, people worry about who's going to maintain it? What happens if there's a gas explosion? You know, and then people are like, too hard. So we'll just do 5 trenches all in parallel that we rip up every other day of the week. Our imaginations are kind of limited by what we know and what we get rewarded for, right? So maybe the answer will be outside of this room. And maybe we should, if we're not wanting to be disrupted too much, need to find some of those disruptors and accelerate their growth.
Panelists were then asked to provide examples of how circular economy principles are being used in the transport sector and how decarbonisation-focused thinking is becoming normalised in infrastructure discussions.
I might just talk about 2 specific examples. One, which is a really exciting one that I saw recently, was in traffic cones, so recycled plastic traffic cones. And why that was so exciting is, A, the collaboration between different organisations to have that, to get that underway. So a construction contractor finding an end-of-life use for their old traffic cones, organisations coming together to find a solution, overcome, make a product that would align with the specifications and the standards. But then the delivery by a social enterprise as well. So for each of the cones produced, that 5 hours of employment for someone with a disability, those with a disability are largely underrepresented in our workforce. So a good solution with some good social outcomes as well. And made in Victoria, actually, and being introduced into a number of contracts, which is really exciting. And then related to, I suppose, that whole of life cycle kind of benefit as well. There's a solution from, been used in the UK for well over a decade now, a product called Rhinofelt to extend the life of, essentially it's a spray seal type solution to prolong the life of a wearing course. And you apply it when the road surface is still in a fair condition and, you know, a couple of years ahead of when you do your normal refurbishment, and you may be able to get should be able to get a number of years longer out of that, reapply it again, get longer out of that pavement.
I have two things that come to mind. One, we, as Roads Australia, we recently had a board meeting at the Australian Road Research Board Lab in Melbourne in Turner Street, which was fascinating. And I encourage those who haven't been there to go and visit or at least connect with it, because it's an incredible asset. Why I speak about that is because when we think about reducing materials, that lab, which is largely focused on road pavements, does an incredible job of actually working with especially remote councils, of helping them come up with how do you use local materials to actually still build a good road. Because, you know, we tend to focus on urban environments, but what I really took away was if you're in central South Australia and, you know, to comply with specifications, normal specifications, you've got to bring materials from 500 kilometres away, that's a massive expense and a massive impact on carbon. Whereas what ARB lab is doing is saying, well, what's local and how do we use that local material to actually make that still a good quality road that's reasonable and fit for purpose for what you really need. But we had a really great story on a project in Melbourne. It's one of the level crossing removal projects at Hurstbridge, and we had to clear this sort of shrubby hillside. And the story came back to me that we have a small project team there, and obviously the traditional approach was get some earth moving equipment in and knock it all down, maybe 2 weeks' work with an excavator and bobcats and a few trucks and haul it off and burn it and so be it. And I'm not sure who it was, but some, you know, few people on the team sort of put their heads together and someone said, let's get some goats in.
Ooh.
And
cute.
Great,
goats.
Isn't it? Well, I don't know if they were cute, but anyway. So, you know, I thought, what a brilliant off the wall thinking, you know, bring some goats in, ate away the shrubs, saved 2 weeks worth of work.
It's
with
a nature based solution, Bede.
Beg pardon?
That's a nature based solution.
Yeah, it's terrific, isn't it?
They were literally and,
Yeah, the goat's got a good feed and we got our side of the hill clean.
Yeah. I mean, my two examples are related sort of to that. So I was helping judge the rail engineering sustainability young professionals competition in Arup, and all the entries from the UK were engineers so proud of the parts of the rail network that they retained and didn't have to rebuild. And that was just for them a part of their design skills, what they thought was good. And I had some of the bridge and civil engineers working with me on Auckland Light Rail, and their first question is, can we retain that bridge? And they were using carbon as a design parameter. And it was just normal, like it was no big deal. There was no sustainability person in the room.
The complex challenge that is decarbonisation was discussed by Alexandra and Bede, with an eye to how industry can be provided certainty in the transition process and what policy adjustments could enable this change and continue delivering infrastructure that improves both economic and broader wellbeing outcomes.
But from a carbon perspective, one thing that we are already very good at is our quality assurance system. So we really just need to go one step further and understand what the carbon content of each of those are and just accept that as a starting point. Now, my view would be that you start with a baseline of carbon unless suppliers can prove that they're lower carbon. Does it have to be perfect in the first instance? No, it doesn't have to be. We wait for perfect, it'll never happen. We can bring that in and continue to develop it. Consistency is much better than much more important than perfection, in my view. But to have us, you know, we have, for instance, the great tragedy at the moment is we are shutting down or not allowing coal mines in Australia that produce the lowest carbon coal that will give us the lowest carbon steel. And yet we're importing high carbon steel from offshore and will continue to with our blinkers on. No, it's we are actually increasing carbon by some of the decisions that are being made at the moment in our society. So we've got to get to this world where we're actually net reducing it.
So when we're, if you're working particularly in multiple jurisdictions, so having an agreed, consistent measurement tool across jurisdictions.
Nationalized
would be fantastic, because then there's clarity then. What are we pricing? What are we designing? What does the client expect to see? And so that we're clear on how that innovation or the way that we're proposing it, how that will be valued in our response, and that what we're being compared on.
You know, I speak often about a bridge project we did in the Philippines, which the Cebu Bridge, which connected this island of Cebu to the mainland. And that, you know, wonderful piece of infrastructure, the life changing of that compared to, probably 3 hours in a ferry to now a 10-minute car drive to get across to jobs, education, health, relatives, social interaction is huge. So we have the same impacts in Australia, not quite as stark as that. So we will continue to grow, and we need to keep building infrastructure to accommodate people and to improve people's lives and opportunities. And so therefore, we've got an obligation to work to say, how do we do that in a responsible way, the most responsible way, having the least impact on the planet as we can? And as I then go back to say, we need, as the private sector, to see consistency. We need to see something that's really long-term that we can rely upon, and then investment will flow. There is no shortage of money to come in. I mean, we're looking at, we're building major wind farms at the moment. We're building transmission lines, tunnels. There is private financing available, and private financing, as Joan said, is much more aligned to what is really the ESG here, because our financing will vary significant percentage points by virtue of the projects and how we can show as a company that it actually is doing the right thing. Now, we, whether we like it or not, because we're European, we actually can't work on coal mines. Now, as I said before, there are some aspects of coal which actually are a really important part of reducing carbon, at least in the near term, but our financing doesn't allow us to work on it. And we've made that decision. So, you know, the finance sector is driving the private sector. It will now have a major impact on government. But I think it's far better if we as a sector get our act together and work consistently rather than having something else imposed upon us.
Joan reiterated the need to rethink the current approach to infrastructure, applying a long-term sustainability lens and being clear about what outcome is being sought before construction begins.
We often, and I've heard people talk about this, end up in a project thinking we need to write this business case to make it happen. You know, it's kind of like, someone's already announced this, we better make this business case work. It would be good for us to, as a society and government, sort of just a proxy for society, to step back and say, you know, what is the problem that crosses departments that we're trying to solve? And we've gone through a big disruption at the moment, COVID. And, you know, I remember years and years of discussion of trying to create regional centres in Victoria, is where I'm from, and get people living out of the city to distribute the population. As soon as COVID happened, everyone voluntarily moved, thank goodness for the NBN. And then the next discussion was, how do we get people back into the city? I'm like, didn't COVID just give you this thing on a platter, right? But the knee-jerk reaction. So the muscle memory of going back to the safety of exactly what we used to do is very strong. And so I think the business case, actually, we need to start off with a long-term plan for our places. And infrastructure is fundamentally a place-based sector where you overlay, you know, the built stuff on top of the commercial stuff, on top of the social stuff. And working us together all through those layers.
Ecologic was discussed by the panel as an example of government policy driving the uptake of recycled materials, supporting decarbonisation efforts, and providing industry with the data needed to derive ongoing value from existing materials.
Those of you you're not familiar with, a body put together for part of the Victorian government initiative to support circular economy and support the application of the recycled first policy. But rather than just them government putting in a target to say, right, major projects, you must include X amount of recycled content, there is about folks on optimizing recycled content. But rather than just setting that target, actually putting an organization that helps sort of provide that wraparound linking organisations together, so linking the makers, the contractors, advocating for those standards, sort of doing that research and helping that. In terms of how you replicate it, well, I think I know the team from Ecologic certainly do go around and sort of advocate and promote that model elsewhere. I think it's the appetite in other jurisdictions to see that's a highly successful model, just looking at their success they've had in the application of recycled content. I think for me, it probably exceeded the expectation of what it was set up to do, just how successful it's been.
I was on the ground floor at Ecologic, right? So I can tell you what happened. Plug, Arup is the technical advisor on the Ecologic program. I also sit on the Sustainability Fund for Victorian Government, so we fund the program. So I do not represent the Victorian Government in what I'm about to say. But from my personal experience watching this, it was a really, really challenging thing to do for a transport agency to say, if I'm going to solve a waste problem. And it was incredibly hard just to set up the communication routes to get people aligned. And it all came down to, and I'll put the credit at his feet, Alan Garner, right? The CEO of MRPV, saying, this is my legacy to my children. And so he said, I want to see recycled content on all the roads. We're going to bash through this. Like, don't talk to me about brand. Don't talk to me about the name. Just get it on the road. And so for a big complex system change, it has to be ambitious enough that some leader is going to put their, reputation and their political cred on the line to drive it. So maybe replicating Ecologic now in other places won't take as much personal risk as that, because we've got a template. But I think anytime you deal with a systems problem, circular economy is a systems problem, you're going to need some leader to stand up and just go, be quiet, everyone. We're just going to go. And so that's what I saw at the start of Ecologic.
With the journey to net zero and decarbonisation in general a long-term mission, the panel finished on a positive note, providing examples of what can be done now to support decarbonisation efforts on the way to a more sustainable industry and future.
But thinking about what else practically can we do? What is the best moves that we can do, whether within your organisation or even better yet, feedback into Roads Australia that we should be thinking about and doing and promoting and setting in place so that we move from just being transactional project-based into something that's bigger and wider and more consistent and really has knowing that which one of these is actually making a difference.
So the first is, if you're involved in setting up contracts or agreements, I'd ask you to consider what are the mechanisms that can allow and support innovation of any type, but particularly circularity. And the second one, whatever your role is, whatever the organisation you're in, challenge you to think about just one thing that you're doing at the moment. If there's something, a different approach that you could take, maybe it's thinking about a whole of life outcome, but one thing that you could do to improve circular outcomes, is there somebody else in this room that if you had that conversation with them, they could perhaps help you get started on that journey?
And that's where we'll end this edition of The Hub. Decarbonisation will remain a top priority for RA, with reduced carbon emissions in the transport sector not just crucial to the sustainability of the industry, but essential to achieving net zero targets on a global level. Recycled material use and an increase in the uptake of circular economy principles is a piece of the decarbonisation puzzle, and with numerous examples of innovative technologies being adopted, highlighted in this podcast, there is reason to look to the future with optimism. RA would again like to thank Tonkin and Taylor for their generous support of this panel discussion. With more exciting podcasts in the pipeline, it's a great idea to subscribe to The Hub on your podcast streaming service and keep an eye out in the RA Insider for the release of new episodes. Thanks for listening in, and we hope you'll join us again soon.